A very warm welcome to all of you to this very special circle with our homegrown Nippon Metta. Like I shared last time he was here, that he's one of our favorite people on this planet. And the exuberance, the love, the energy that he radiates just keeps us ticking. And I know why he keeps going. It's because of all the jet lag. Because when he's jet lagged, there's no sense of self. So thank you for being with us here today. And also the Honorable Sri Rajmohanji is with us today, and Srimati Ushaji. So we're very, very honored to have you here today. Thank you for your presence. Jinwei from California, from San Francisco Monastery. Thank you, welcome. And we have Trishna, our UK anchor for service space, without which we wouldn't even be here. So, and we have all our Awaken London and UK hosts here as well. So we have Ani from Mill Hill, and Vicky and Shamash, and Eva, is Eva here? No? Okay, so thank you all. And we have Kai from Japan as well, who's joining us today. So thank you very much. And I'm gonna pass you over to Trishna now, and we'll speak later. Thank you.
Welcome everyone, and thank you Mita and Sanjay for creating such a beautiful space for us to come together. There was a bit of debate, inside, outside, is it gonna rain, is the storm coming, is it not? And that you chanced upon such a beautiful evening to be sitting in the garden like this. Thank you for offering this gift of this space to all of us. In a normal awakened circle, as some of you know, we would each take a minute, we would sit in silence and then each take a minute to share our reflections on a reading that's offered. And tonight we'll be all gifting our minute each to our special guests who joined us this evening to hear some words of inspiration and stories from their journey. I'll start with Nippon, who's a dear friend. We were just recently talking about, it's been exactly 20 years this April since Service Base kind of planted its first seeds. And it's been such a joy to kind of serve in this way together with such a beautiful community of people from so many walks of life and all over the world. And it's been every London visit you are on plants more seeds in people's hearts to just dig deep and serve and cultivate compassion and love for each other and for the world. So thank you. I know you have a very busy life, and it's a joy to welcome you in what's become an annual trip, it feels like, right guys? We're always excited to know when London makes it into the itinerary somewhere. And a very warm welcome also to Jinwei, who many of you may remember joined Reverend Heng Shur's delegation that came a couple of years ago. We met him when he was a newly ordained novice monk, just a couple of months into his new journey as a monk. And it's a joy to welcome you back just a couple of years later. And I was sharing with somebody just earlier how I think Jinwei's journey as a monk was summed up to me in a recent service-based retreat that he joined, where he said, "The beginner's mind has limitless possibilities. I hope I can always maintain the mind of a novice monk forever." And it's been such a joy having these last 4 days together. This gathering is the culmination of a four-day visit that they've been on together, which started with a little circle on Friday with some of the anchors and expanded to a beautiful retreat with about 50 of us coming together to share on the theme of building bridges in times of disconnection. Yesterday, Nippon spent some time with some young adults and teenagers in the morning talking about service and giving, receiving, and not keeping track, and just letting it flow. In the afternoon, we all got to go to Compassion College for a couple of hours, where we learned kind of the different practices and different things that we can embrace to cultivate compassion in our hearts. And today, we all come together for the finale, which is usually an awakened circle if it's a Nipun visit, to hold space for what is about to emerge. I'll hand over to Nipun to also introduce another very special guest Mita mentioned we have with us.
Oh, happy to be here. I feel like we need like the Wimbledon umpires, right? Is it rain delay or are we still good? So far, so good. As Trisha said, my name is Nipun, and I'm always moved by grace. These unexpected things that happen by no seeming action of our own. Today, one of those acts of grace is sitting next to me. this is Raj Mohan Gandhi, who is the grandson of Gandhi. The Gandhi.
A grandson
of the Gandhi. I will ask him to share. We met exactly 20 minutes before the meditation, but more than those 20 minutes of content, we spent, I think, an hour or 45 minutes in silence together, and that's perhaps the greatest introduction to share each other's presence. I'll share a little bit more about him and put him on the spot at some point, either before or after the rain delay, we'll see. But it's beautiful, right? How it's just one fine day you're walking along and, you know, guess who comes to an awakened circle? I mean, for me, Gandhi has been one of the greatest inspirations of my life. And so to be next to a grandson of Gandhi is a real honor and a privilege. And a privilege, I think, because of the values that Gandhiji stood for. It's not so much Gandhi the person or Gandhi the change agent, but Gandhi the seeker that moved me and moves me to this day the most. There's a beautiful quote by Ruskin that I paraphrase. This is not the exact quote, but this is how I remember it, that Gandhi was also moved by. And he said that we are not what we do. He didn't say this, I'm saying this, but it's a paraphrase of his quote. We are not what we do, but who we become by what we do. And I think that's a very significant shift in our narrative. That all too often, I don't know if you've been in these meetings, but I've definitely been in so many meetings where people will, before you even say hi, hello, like the business card comes. And it's to say, yeah, in case I'm not worth your time, I just want you to know my title might be worth your time. And that's understandable because they've probably been conditioned in that way, and which is probably why they got those titles in the first place. And we do this in social change. For those of us that are moved by the suffering of the world, suffering of others, and suffering of ourselves, for those of us that are moved in this way, we often want to create change. We want to try to do something. We care. We are moved by love. And when we're moved in this way, we create projects. And all too often, we say those projects start leading our presence. Right? It's like, who are you? Well, you know, how many things have I done? How many lives have I changed? How many buildings have I built? And we forget that we're not what we do, but who we become by what we do. I was at a gathering recently, and there were a bunch of very, people who had done a lot of amazing things in the world. There were about 40 of them, and we were seated in a circle like this. And somehow I got pitted as like one end of the spectrum. And there was another guy who was on the other end of the spectrum. And, they were like, go fight, it's not in my nature to do that. So I was trying to build bridges. But it was really, it was interesting because that gentleman went first and he starts sharing and he says, you know, he spoke passionately about how he took his first company public, about how in the last 2 years of him trying to create a social business, he raised $370 million. How, you know, this list of things just went on and on. And it's inspiring in a certain frame of reference. And then it was my turn to speak, and I'm thinking, oh my God, like, okay. My bank balance is like pretty close to, it doesn't have any ones in front of it. You know, there's still zeros, but, and I looked at my work and I said, you know, I'm not even sure I know I can count. I can keep track of really what difference I've made. And I was trying to build a bridge, and this quote came to my mind, what I just shared with you, that you're not what we do, but who you become by what we do. And I gave this example, and I want to give you two of those examples today, actually, that both of which I shared. One was of this man named Dr. V, who revolutionized eye care. He was crippled with rheumatoid arthritis in his late 50s. Like, if you would touch his bed, he would shriek in pain. In that condition, he says, I want to be of service. What am I going to do? And he realized that a half an hour eye surgery for those who had very little could end up giving them eyesight. So he says, I'm going to become an ophthalmologist at that age. And he becomes an ophthalmologist. And it takes him several years, actually, to learn how to hold the instruments because his hands were crippled. And that goes on to become the world's largest network of eye hospitals. He's incidentally my sister-in-law's grandfather. And as his work took off, it's a Harvard case study, and they've done remarkable things. Like for one of those cataract surgeries, it used to be $300. They brought it down to $3. There's just so many stories to be told about it. But the story that I was sharing in this one circle, I said that as his work became bigger, Dr. V became smaller. He walked into one of his hospitals one day, and he was a very simple person. He had he was wearing simple clothes. He kind of walks in with a cane, and he looks, it doesn't look like your typical CEO material, you know. And so he was walking in, and they had just gotten a new security guard. And the security guard's like, hey, what are you doing? And he's like, I need to go there. And he's like, no, you can't go there. That's the executive wing. You go wait over there. And Dr. Wee's like trying to talk to him and explain. And the guy's like, no, can't do that. You got to go over there. You know, he just wouldn't, because it was the first day. And he was just so excited about being all gung-ho about his role. And so what does Dr. V do? He says, all right. He goes and sits over there for 2 hours until his sister comes, who was also the co-founder of the hospital, and she's not quite Dr. V, so she looked at him, like, what are you doing here? And she goes and tells the guy, and Dr. V says, no, it's okay. It's his first day, let him be. And he goes on. But you think about that and you say, who do you have to be? Oh, we get an umbrella. There you are. This is a chair umpire. Who do you have to be? When you do this work, I often face this. It's like, there's so many things to do with your time. And you overinflate your worth. You're like, I'm so busy. I don't know if I can do this or if I go here. What are my takeaways? What did I get? Is it worth my time? Even kids do this, right? And that's such an overinflated sense of self. Whereas here was Dr. V, a guy because of whom millions of people have eyesight. A guy who's like done remarkable things in the world, and his security guard won't let him in, and he just sits there patiently because he realizes it's this guy's first day of work, and he's just expressing his zeal. How many CEOs would do that? Even if you're humble, you may do that, but how many CEOs would sit there for 2 hours and say, let me just see what grace has in store for us. Because this whole thing wasn't by my design anyways. Takes a very different kind of person. It's not what you do, it's who you become by what you do. The resume is right here. We spent the first hour in silence. That's really the best way to meet each other. It's even despite age differences. It's an inside joke. I'm not making fun of his age, all right? I promise.
He's now underlining it. Yeah.
Another one of my friends, mentors, an elder who's also passed away. Dr. Vee passed away also a few years ago. This man revolutionized sanitation in India. He built toilets, hundreds of thousands of toilets. This started over 125 organizations in a decentralized way. Could have made tons of money, never did. Pure Gandhian to his core. And he did so many things. So when he passed away in a rather remarkable way. I won't get into this story, but he was a very noble person, pure heart. He wasn't what he was doing, he was what he was becoming, kind of a guy. When he passed away, it had to shut down the whole street by the Gandhi Ashram. All kinds, you know, I think like 10,000 people came from the janitors because he was doing the work of sanitation. He was doing the work of, you know, and it's not just sanitation. You're actually, there's so many social programs embedded in just a toilet. You know, it's a complex situation and you can talk a lot about it. But at his funeral, all these people spoke. From like the highest dignitaries to janitors, and everyone was there, everyone was expressing love. And at the end, his wife goes up and he says, "You know about all the work that he did, but I lived with him for 58 years. And I want to tell you his real introduction. This was a man that never once in our entire life together, never once got angry with me. $500,000 toilets, piece of cake. Never getting angry with someone you see every day in every encounter, not a piece of cake. We are not what we do. We are who we become by what we do. And in some sense, I try to remind myself of that. And in those moments where I'm focusing on that, I think my wife, I don't know what my wife would say. For those of you that know my wife, let me not brag about it. Yes, I'm a really angry guy, you know, this guy. She says, "Well, all right, I don't worry. We get along." But I think when we focus on who we are becoming, we start to empty ourselves, and as we empty ourselves, we become instruments of this grace, of the unknown, where you really can't take credit for the things that are happening through you. Because that's the one thing that's you might be the last tipping point, but how many things need to happen for that one action to take place? It's a lot. And when you're just aware of that final tipping point, it's easy to take credit for it. But if your frame of reference is the whole, it becomes very hard to take credit for it. To the point that it becomes very hard to even actually say that I did this and I should get paid in this way. People who see the whole spectrum just cannot get paid. It's like a mom would never look at her newborn and say, I need to get paid for this because I put so much labor into it. It's a ridiculous question. But that's actually how ridiculous it is for all of us to engage in this tit for tat with any action. But we just forget that. And I think as we remember that, we become instruments of grace. Maybe not 100% of the time. Mid-sentence, you can do that if you've known somebody for 20 years. Maybe not 100% of the time. But even in those moments, even in those one or two moments, it feels like a real blessing. And so I didn't know what our topic was going to be, but it has emerged. And I would say, Gandhi and grace. I'll give you a few more minutes to think about it. But when we look at social change agents, we often cheapen and reduce their journeys, their stories, into what they've done. And while, of course, that is significant, perhaps what's even more significant is who they became. And even more significant than who they became was what they were seeking through that becoming process. And so I look at the social change heroes, some like Gandhi and Mother Teresa, but some everyday heroes. Because if it's not about all the outside stuff, the size of what you do is just an externality. All right, maybe what Jinwei does touches millions of people, maybe what I do touches two people. But it doesn't matter because we're instruments of the same grace. So yeah, my right leg cannot really compare to all the things my right and left hand has done. Just apples and oranges, but it doesn't matter. We're part of the same body. You're each playing your same role. So when I look at deep social change, and I look at my social change heroes that are moved by the spirit of inner transformation and external service, or rather I should say, when I look at the social change heroes that I'm moved by, I see that they do their external service by being moved in the spirit of inner transformation. And Gandhi was most certainly in that category. And we have among us this tremendous honor, not just of a biological lineage, but of a person that has deeply studied Gandhi and has, in a very balanced way, looked at Gandhi's life, not in a way of, wow, he was larger than life. Maybe that's what someone like me would do. But he, you know, to give you his, just, I don't want to introduce what he has done because we're talking about what he's becoming. But one of my introductions to him was a book that he wrote. He's written many books, but one of them was in 2007. And one of my friends is a sort of pioneer in the world of social or nonviolent social change, and a Gandhian scholar, a preeminent sort of world-renowned scholar, has written many books himself, Michael Nagler. When I met with him, he told me that he says, I think I've probably read every single book on Gandhi. And I was like, all right, well, that's great. That's like every single one more than me. You know, I don't know if I've read like so many books on Gandhi. And I said, well, can you give me a recommendation, you know, a shortcut? Which one should I read? And he says, you know, I wouldn't have thought that I would recommend a book that's published so late, I think 2007 or 2008. But this is the best book on Gandhi that I have read. And that was a book by Rajmohan Gandhi. It's titled Gandhi The man.
His people and the empire. There you are.
So since we have this tremendous privilege and you guys all have such grace to have an upgrade from me as a speaker, we'd love to invite Raj Mohanji. First of all, thank you for being here. And we would love to invite you to share on whatever you're moved to share, ultimately. But if I had to pose a seed question, it would be the role of inner transformation in Gandhi's work and the role of sort of unexplained merit, grace in his work.
Thank you very much. See, since I am twice your age, I will call you Nipun.
Yes.
I thank you. I thank everyone. In my life, I have occasionally spent quiet times, or often spent quiet times. But I can't believe that this was only 45 minutes. This was 45 minutes because it went like that. So that's because of all of you. So I wanted to acknowledge this, that I imagine many of you too have experienced, but I wanted to acknowledge that this period went by in a flash. Secondly, I do want to thank the Almighty for every single one of you here. I will try to answer a question about Gandhi. Maybe I'll start with that. Nipun said to me before we came here for the awaken that Gandhi was many things, but above all, he was a seeker, and I absolutely share that evaluation. And yes, he wanted India's independence, he wanted Hindu-Muslim friendship, he wanted justice among India's hierarchically divided castes. But above all, Gandhi wanted the deepest possible experience of the spirit of the Almighty. And so that was his deepest longing, his constant prayer. Even as he did his social, political, economic leadership training, educating the nation, arousing the British conscience, he had so many tremendous goals. But my understanding as I followed his life very closely is that at almost each minute or each second of every endeavor of his was this parallel and deeper longing, searching, which was of a spiritual kind. So I think that is absolutely a valid observation that you make. And so we will not understand Gandhi if we don't understand that central truth about him. But if you'll allow me, Nipun, I will also mention what I did just before I came to this beautiful space. We didn't want to arrive too early, so we had a little time. So Krish, who is our host here, who has kindly brought Usha and me to this place, he said, how about seeing Harrow, the school? All of you have seen it, of course. And I saw it, and Usha and I, and of course I was aware of the fact that Churchill had gone there and Jawaharlal Nehru had gone there. Now here I must tell you that apart from my Gandhi book, I've written another fairly well-known, well-acclaimed, highly acclaimed book, greatly acclaimed book, is The Life of Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel. I wrote this in late 1980s, published in 1990. It keeps getting republished in Gujarati, English, and now Hindi translation is to come. And I wrote this book because Vallabhbhai Patel, I felt, had been half forgotten, neglected. He was an amazing person. And of course, it's appropriate, natural, for any observer of Indian history to compare Jawaharlal Nehru and Vallabhbhai Patel. And my book on Patel also takes often a critical view of Jawaharlal Nehru on many issues. I had met Patel, I had met Nehru. Gandhi was 6 or 7 years older than Patel, and Patel was 14 years older than Jawaharlal. Jawaharlal was 20 years younger than Gandhi. But as I went to the school and recall Jawaharlal Nehru, I also thought of the calumny that Jawaharlal Nehru has been facing today. The false attacks, the unfounded attacks. He was a human being. He was an imperfect human being, a flawed human being like every one of us is. And if you are a prime minister, then your weaknesses and your flaws are important. But he was also a wonderful human being. And I felt at Harrow seeing him, of course I was also conscious of Churchill, also a flawed human being, but also a very great human being. I mean, what Churchill has said and not said about M.K. Gandhi, my goodness. And yet I couldn't but feel a very great warmth for Winston Churchill. And I couldn't help feel a very great warmth for Jawaharlal Nehru, and a very great sadness that he is subject to such calumny, falsehood, lies. Just as many of you are aware, you know that certain percentage of people in the United States think that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. A larger percentage of many Indians in India today think that Jawaharlal Nehru and Motilal Nehru were Muslims. Not that being a Muslim is necessarily so bad, but absolute sustained propaganda over the years through every kind of media. If you Google Motilal Nehru, you will see it. So I wanted to say that, as I was mentioning also to you when we first met inside, that this notion of love is, of course, the central thing. And yet it is a reality that in this world, which does see so many moments of grace, abundant grace, amazing grace, but it also sees the opposite of love at times. It sees hatred, not only prejudice, not only ignorance, but malice and ill will and deliberate injection of toxicity. So I wanted to share that also, because I feel that our task in the world, of course, is to see if we can, by some prayer or effort or whatever, invite grace and love and goodness. But I believe that sometimes it's also a task to identify the not so pretty things, the ugly things, the ill will, the malice, and at times not only to hope that it'll be overcome, but at times also to identify it and speak about it truthfully. So that was and the last thing, maybe you allow me to mention a brief autobiographical reference. It's connected to this. My father, Devdas Gandhi, was Gandhiji's fourth son. Sadly, he had no daughters. There was Harilal Gandhi, Manilal Gandhi, Ramdas Gandhi, and Devdas Gandhi. My father was the editor of the Hindustan Times in New Delhi, which is where I was born. When I was 16 or so, I was, and our apartment was in the same building where the newspaper was being published. Printed. And one morning a journalist came, my father was the editor of the newspaper and I was at home at that time. Journalist came and he brought a scrap of paper. It said, Liaquat Ali Khan, Prime Minister of Pakistan, has been shot at MTF. I knew that MTF meant more to follow. Shot at MTF. I opened the door, this man came in, I looked, took the piece of paper from him. And I looked at it and I said, oh, I hope what follows is that Liaquat Ali Khan is dead. So I thought I had made a clever remark. I was expecting a smile from him. Instead, I got a frown. Of course, it was a very stupid, idiotic remark for me to make. Later on, when I was thinking about my embarrassment at my stupid remark, I realized that perhaps there were two reasons. A, I shared a popular prejudice. Pakistan was sort of an enemy country. He was the prime minister of Pakistan by this time. Also, I was a young boy trying to be a man, wanting to sound macho. So I recognized that being Gandhi's grandson didn't make me automatically a loving man. It made me a mean type of fella. And that meanness can continue in me all the time. So I wanted to mention that. I think I wanted to mention that and speak about this other aspect because I feel that in addition to seeking, working for, inviting, summoning, begging for, meditating for love, maybe also contribute to the lessening of ill will, the removal of toxicity, poison, and hate. Thank you so very much.
You can't get away that easy. How do you suppose we do that? Because one theory of change is that we need to turn on the light and the darkness would go away. People like Vinoba Bhave, Gandhi's spiritual successor, often spoke about this. But in today's context, what are you seeing? Because you're so active, you're a scholar, you're involved in so many circles and dialogues, and sometimes really in the heart of very difficult situations. How do you feel we can address this in a loving way?
I wish I had a clear or simple answer to this. I think we should all search for this. I don't think that it is enough to feel that spreading of love will eliminate this somehow, or spreading of light will by itself eliminate this darkness. I think there are moments when different ones of us at the right time must also be willing to say this is darkness and that this darkness should not be encouraged. So that is also truth, which I think goes very much with love.
So do you feel that we are lacking that calling out right now?
Yes. In many parts of the world, that is lacking. Many wonderful people are unwilling to identify and to denounce ugliness, darkness, hatred.
And what do you feel would help those people to not slip it under the rugs?
I think if they see us doing it, then they may also do it. Possibly, I don't know. But this is a very difficult question. Very difficult question. Because also we do know that in many parts of the world, ill will is politically successful. So toxicity, you know, is like that. So I don't know the answer to this, but I'm very glad that you are encouraging all of us to explore an answer to this. It is a very important question.
Last question would be on Gandhian grace or Gandhian inner transformation. What do you feel? Because you know so many anecdotes from his life. What do you feel moved him, and what was the source of his love? Because one of the things he often said was that he had, for example, more faith in the law of love than the law of electricity. And so here was a man who was tuned in at a very deeper level. How do you think that factored into the work that he did? I'm going to keep going back to love.
It's not so easy to answer that, but you know, one of the answers is and it's been surprised many of you. He was loved incredibly by his mother and father. He writes this. He says that nobody, he thinks that nobody received as much love from his parents as I have received. So if you've received so much love at a young age, I think that gives you somehow a desire to return it to everybody else, and perhaps even gives you some capacity to do it. But I think it was divine grace that entered him again and again and again and again. But one foundation of his ability to, I mean, is, you know, for many of us, I think it's true, those associated with Gandhi or who kind of encouraged or inspired by him, it's not difficult for us even to love Churchill, is it? You know, we know the, some of the harsh things Churchill has said. And let me say this, when Gandhi was killed, I was 12 and a half, I was often attend prayer meetings with him. And I was aware, even I, as a young boy of 10, 11, was alive to the hostility that Gandhi himself faced. But when Gandhi was killed, and I was not there present, but I was taken, the thought of who killed him, who is that man, I'll be angry with him, never entered my mind. Never entered my mind, because it never entered Gandhi's mind. I mean, Gandhi knew that he was likely to be killed. And some of you may know this, he was meeting a few Muslim friends every day in the last several months of his life. And these Muslim friends felt that they were representing a vulnerable group in Delhi, and there were difficulties. So they wanted to keep Gandhi updated about what was the situation. And Gandhi was aware that he might be attacked. He would say to his Muslim friends, I think this was on an Eid day, he said to them, please pray for me that when my assassin comes to kill me, I will be able to forgive him. So he not only himself wishes to forgive his likely assassin, he wants the Muslims of Delhi, who have had this history of great tension and conflict with the Hindus, also to pray. So I feel that somehow, whether we call it divine grace, almighty grace, or whatever, that struck Gandhi again and again in his life.
It reminds me of an anecdote that happened while I was reading your book. I live in Berkeley, and I was gonna go get, I'm inspired to more than what I do, who I become, right? So I was gonna go get my wife some of her favorite food and score some brownie points. So I was gonna go. Those of you that have been in Berkeley know that I am, you know, it's very hard to find parking. I guess London's the same. So I went in and I was gonna park and go get food and come home. And right as I was about to go inside, to park in, you know, parallel park, this guy comes from behind and decides to take that spot. And I was like, okay, this is wrong, right? Like, that was, there's no way. I mean, it wasn't gray area. Like, it was, I was clearly there first, you know? It was like, and it was, you know, I said, okay, how am I gonna respond to what feels like injustice to me? And I said, you know, and I was reading your book, and I think that might have influenced me, Gandhi and who he was. Gandhi, of course, said that 10% should be satyagraha, which is resisting what is wrong, and 90% should be constructive program. So he actually gave a very precise idea. If you're just going out and yelling and saying, I'm going to call you out, and that's all you're doing 100% of the time, that wouldn't quite be Gandhian. And so, but you do have to kind of call out. And so I was like, okay, what am I going to do? So I decided in an uncharacteristic way, for me, I was like, okay, I think I'm going to get out of my car, you know, and I'm gonna go meet this guy, because I just felt like it was clearly, it was gray area. I'd still have some doubts, you know. I'm like, oh, give him benefit of the doubt, be kind, be loving. It's just not a gray area. So I was like, okay, I got out of the car, I didn't know who was going to be in there. And I was like, okay, Nabun, you really want to be this guy? I said, okay, yeah, okay, do it with love, do it with love. I'm going, I'm calling him out, knocking on the window. I see that it's actually, I'm kind of relieved that it's a young person and not like some big muscular guy is ready to take it on me. I see him, he looks at me, and I said, do you think that's your parking spot? I said something like that. It was very clear that what he did was sort of unethical in a small sort of a way. And he couldn't even look at me. He looked down. But I think where I'm moved by love, where I think 90% is not just 10% is satyagraha, right? 90% has got to be this deeper movement. I told him that, you know, why don't you keep this spot? But next time, don't do this to somebody else, because what if that was your sister or your mother or your loved one? Because you can go into that situation and you say, well, this is wrong, and I want to change you. And that just feels very violent to me. To me, at least for my makeup. Mm-hmm. But how do you hold that space with a heart of love and generosity? That I'm doing this in a principled way. I'm not actually doing it to let you know how I'm morally superior and how your anger is like lower grade and how all your actions are lower consciousness and how I'm holier than thou. It's actually saying, hey, yeah, man, you know, it could be that I'm related to you on the other end. And let me be generous. Let me offer. And so how do we tend to do that? And I think another thing that I've learned through this process is that sometimes when your generosity isn't received, I remember I was driving in the car one day, and I had just come from an event and someone gave me sweets. I have a sweet tooth. Wait, Gandhi had a sweet tooth too, right? Oh man, then I'm all right. See, there you are. SMS to my wife, right? It's a sweet tooth, okay. So someone had given me a box of sweets, and it's really something I loved, and we were going down, the traffic is slow, and someone knocks on the window and says, you know, do you have something? Can you get some money? So I looked at him, and I said, "Well, I didn't feel moved to give money, but I took out a piece of sweet, and I said, somebody just gave this to me, and this is something that I love, right? So I was like, let me give it to you. So I gave it to him, and the car started moving, and I looked at this man, and I was just curious: is he going to enjoy it as much as I would, right? I looked at this guy, he took this and he threw it down on the ground. And when you do that, it's a little bit awkward, right? Like, you're like, you know? That was my favorite piece of sweet, and B, you know, that's really not a nice thing to do. I mean, you know, it just didn't, you feel kind of violated. But then the second thought I had was that maybe it wasn't between me and this guy in the first place. Because of our egos, we're so wrapped up in assessing the situation the way our minds want to assess it. And I realized that maybe it was actually an act of generosity from the person who gave me those sweets to the ants on the ground who are going to eat those sweets. I made it about us. Because you're so self-centered. And that's the first thought that comes up. And when a person is so self-centered, what kind of solutions is that person really capable of? Because that's the extent to which you can see. Gandhi used to have one-minute meetings. 1 minute. Like, can you imagine like a CEO of a company saying, okay, I'm going to come in and go out? Like those people who had those 1 minute meetings, they felt deeply satisfied. Not because it was like a selfie and I got to meet Gandhi, I'm going to brag on my Facebook wall, right? But there was something about his presence that moved people. And even how he felt hatred of other people. I read this also in your book in Rajkot.
Yes.
When those bandits, Gandhiji was up on stage and all these people came in and saying, let's see how strong your nonviolence is, and all these bandits came in and they literally started beating the audience. There were 700-800 people, And I mean, it's like, I feel like the teacher's in the classroom, right? So I better say my facts right. You know, I'm like looking at him. Like, yeah, 7,800 or was it 6,700? You know, okay. He's too kind to correct me. There were hundreds of people at 7,800. And Gandhi's up on stage. And these people come and literally start, they're saying, nonviolence? Let's see how strong your nonviolence is. People were bleeding. They'd be taken to the hospital. All these things, and all of a sudden, there's this mayhem, right? Like, everyone going all over the place. Like, yeah, love, nonviolence, let's see how far that goes. Gandhiji's up on stage, and it must occur to somebody to, like, kind of look and say, hey, how is he taking it? And he's actually convulsing.
Shaking.
That when that person is harming another person and all those people are doing this at scale, there is a negativity that's there, and this man was actually feeling that negativity, perhaps. But he starts shaking and he gets up, and he's pretty old at the time, and he needs to go, and they were saying that it's not safe for you to be here. And so they were trying to whisk him away, and Gandhiji says that actually, I'd like to go and speak to the leader of that gang. And he says, not only to, so they said, okay, well, if you're going to do this, I'm sure they were initially worried. If you're going to do this, they said, we better get a few big guys. Shamash, you might have been one of them, right? Get it around him. And he says, no, I don't want anybody there.
Oh, I'm fine.
I appreciate the shawl too. No, I don't. I'm teasing. So he's starting to convulse, and he's saying, I want to go and meet the leader of the gang. All these people are trying to protect him. He says, no, I'll go alone. There's one or two people, I think, just for support that he was holding on to.
Bal Khalilkar.
Narasimha Kalekar's son, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And he holds on to these people. He goes and talks to this guy, and he says, I want to hear your point. Why are you doing this? And at the end of that conversation, this guy says, it's not safe for you to be here. Let me show you the way out. But I suppose for me, the way I parse that story, it's an incredible story. Mm-hmm. Happened in Rajkot, yeah?
Yes.
See, I'm passing with all five.
1939.
There you are. I didn't know that, but okay. But what does it mean to actually have that state of interbeing? We were talking about that. That he's not going and saying this is wrong, or maybe he is, but he's actually going with this incredible humility to say, I'm father of the nation. Even if you massacre these 800 people, man, I mean, I've got a whole movement on my hands. But here he is saying, I want to listen to your point. And he did this with the most amazing, even with religion. He did this. He had these dialogues with atheists, and he was very clearly a man of God. And he says, I want to hear your point. And I've actually met the sons of some of these people. And they said, if you can make more sense of it, I'm ready to change. I'm ready to transform. I'm ready to go. So what does it mean? What kind of a mind do you have to carry to do so much and yet have the humility of a beginner's mind? To me, these are very interesting questions. These are questions that you don't see traditional leaders kind of holding. You don't have these kinds of anecdotes. You don't have a kind of visceral connection to others' pain. And how can you cultivate in that awareness? And when you actually deepen in that awareness, how would you respond? I think is a very different thing than you do it without that awareness. This is my book promo. I'm done with this. This is 2008.
No, it's not. It's not. No.
I think it brings up a lot of different questions. We didn't go in the direction of Gandhi and grace because this is how we are flowing. But I actually think it is related to grace, because I think that you can't get to that point because you want to. At some point, your effort is too cheap.
Since I'm a historian, and I just add one little bit from that story. So Bal Kalilkar, who was very young at the time, maybe a little older, in his 20s. So he was supporting Gandhi. And he saw that as Gandhi was trembling and shaking in this atmosphere, Gandhi started to pray and to use his favorite name for the Almighty, Ram. So he said, Ram, Ram. And Bal Kalilkar, also, this is a very important part of the story, he decided to support and help Gandhi. So he, as Gandhi was saying, Ram, Ram, Bal Kalilkar was patting him on his back. Yes. And he says that after a few seconds, that Gandhi, his shaking stopped, and he was completely at peace. And then he decided to go and meet the leader of the gang that was attacking everybody. So he sought grace, and Bal Kalilkar contributed to Gandhi receiving grace. Yes.
So maybe should we do questions? I mean, I've been greedy in asking all the questions. Maybe I should be generous and let you guys ask questions. Sanjay's getting nervous about rain, and he's saying, man. Oh, Mike Runner, always serving. Sanjay is one of the hosts here. So if you have any thoughts or reflections. And then before it starts raining, we'll conclude. Maybe. I don't know how. But oh, maybe I'll do a song. I've never sang a song. I know one song, but Jingle Bells, no.
Thank you. I must start by saying how touched I am to be in such a privileged and esteemed company. Thank you. I must thank Krishna and the Museum of Happiness, Vicky and Ori, color-coordinated with an Orin Shaw and Shamash, who are also, these are the Museum of Happiness and circles that I go to, and it's only thanks to these lovely people that I'm here. My question is quick and short, really, and it is, what advice would you give us to live happy lives, please?
He'll bring you the mic. Oh, no, he's looking at you. they're going for the upgrade, man. It's no longer economy. They're like, we got.
I think you should marry a wonderful wife. I know that I don't know. Truly, I cannot truthfully say that I've been very lucky in life, very lucky in so many ways. I've found great joys and satisfactions in life. I've had my share of disappointments also, of course, but I've had a very, very happy life. But in my case, my happiness has been an undeserved gift. But I think here some others may know how to achieve happiness. I'm merely somebody who can tell you that it's a good thing when you receive it.
Hi, my question's for Nippon. You mentioned that you were one spectrum and you were pitted against someone else that was on the other side of the spectrum, and then you were measured essentially. And then you spoke of how when you see the wider picture, you see less of yourself, and you're seeing the greater picture, so you don't mind so much. How do you get to that point? How do you be okay with a comparison within yourself or someone else, comparing you to someone else that's doing something similar to what you're doing, that's more successful than you are. When your efforts are so sincere, but you're just not, you're not getting there. Like, how do you be okay with that?
You know, I give you an anecdote that really moved me, and a principle. So one of my friends was, he does a lot of work in prisons. And so he was doing a circle like this, much smaller, of people who had at least committed one murder each. And they were in for life. And they were meditating and doing this restorative circle. And at some point in the circle, so he goes and he asks everybody, how many years, there was a board, and he says, how many years have you been in jail? Prison. There's actually a difference between prison and jail. Okay, but and so he says, 40 years, 10 years, 29 years. And he added it all up, like, say, over 425 years. Then he created another column, and he asked them, how long was your moment of rage for which you are here? 3 minutes, 2 minutes, maybe 48 minutes. And he added it up. And for a couple hours of rage, collectively, we are going to spend hundreds of years in jail. And you can imagine, with that kind of mirroring, the circle takes on a whole different flavor. And as everyone went around, one of the guys says, you know what I think? I think hurt people hurt people. That I was in this pattern of rage because I had been subject to that rage. And perhaps whoever started that was also subject to that rage. So they went around the circle and they went a little farther. And it was somebody else's turn. And he says, I'd like to add to that. And he says, I think healed people heal people. And I think when we look at the spectrum of cause and effect, if we see in a very linear way, I did this and this happened. I create this and this happened. If we just see one cause to one effect in such a linear way, it becomes very reductionist. And you are unable to hold the suffering that comes your way or the suffering that others are experiencing around you. But if you're able to expand that frame and realize that actually, you know, this moment, how do you think this happened? Yeah, Trishna gave me a ride here. But I can start to unpack that, and I would go all the way to my birth. And I don't really know why I took birth in the family that I did. And you don't know why you took birth with the parents you have. And no one else does. And really, this is a grand conspiracy that started then or even before. And if you're able to hold all of that for your own life, then you'll be able to hold other people in that way. So that to the degree to which that you're wanting credit is the degree to which you minimize this frame for other people as well. So the more you're taking credit for all this is... the more you're reducing the frame, and the more you reduce your frame, the less you can see others in a longer, larger frame. So I think a lot of it goes back to, it's much harder to actually look at yourself and say, ah, okay, yeah, I didn't do all that. I'm not that amazing. I'm not the center of the world. And if you can see that, then you say, okay, well, this person is not the center of their action, not alone, not the center alone. It's a complex web of causes and condition. Make sense?
Thank you. Hi. You said that you are a historian. So I want to ask you, do you think that we're at a point where we're going through, collectively, we're going through a lot of pain to birth something new in the same way that has that we have in our little history of human beings on this planet? Or do you think that we are really at a point unprecedented in scale and in, you know, and in kind of magnitude, because I feel like on one hand, you know, we have to go through this for the elevation of consciousness or for that path that, you know, is inevitable. But without the perspective of someone who has looked into history and I just wonder whether this is like, you know, one of those waves that we've seen before, or really this is something maybe scarier or bigger, or something that's kind of like close to the end of us.
So, you know, historians are not astrologers. However, you ask a very important question, and I've wrestled with it, whether what we are facing today is something unique and unprecedented or not. It is unprecedented in one way. So, for instance, when fascism and Nazism appeared in the world, there were many great parts of the world that saw, even they didn't see the danger in time, they saw it eventually. And they mobilized intellectual and material resources to stand up to fight it. Today, what is happening is that this polarization, or this valorization of ill will, a valorization of intolerance, is taking place in almost every country in the world. And it's very hard to see which country or which group of countries will mobilize intellectual and spiritual and material resources to reverse the tide. That is a, you might say, a disturbing picture. But there is another more positive picture, which is the picture that all of us see whenever we travel now in any part of the world. We see that the world is coming together as never before. Our street scenes are totally different from the street scenes 30, 40, 50 years ago. All races, all nationalities seem to be learning to live together and often to enjoy living together. So at this moment, both trends are being noticed. Which trend will win out, and how it will pan out, how the struggle will pan out, is beyond my capacity to say. I think Dad, if one person is being pampered to the exclusion of everybody else.
No, it's actually giving us happiness to pamper you, so thank you.
Pranam Gandhiji. I wanted to ask you, do you believe countries can have collective karma? Like, if you look at the UK, currently the consciousness of the people of the UK, in some way I feel they still reminisce about the times of empire, rather than maybe having a balanced perspective and maybe also repenting in relation to the collective harm and suffering that was caused. And maybe that, I believe, can manifest in things that we're seeing now within the UK and maybe in the US.
I don't know about whether countries have a collective karma or not, but I will make an observation that is connected to what you're saying. You're quite right that although there is some reflection on the sinfulness of empire, it is a limited reflection so far, I accept that. On the other hand, I feel that there is a great deal that the new Brits can also do for this country. The new Brits, you know, when I first came here in 1956 as a student, I also was a trainee on the Scotsman newspaper in Edinburgh for a year. At that time, there were not many Indians to be seen on the street, or many, yes, there were some from other parts of the world, but by and large, this was a white man's country. Now it's totally different. And those of us who live here from other parts of the world, whether we are from the Caribbean or Africa or other parts of Asia, India, wherever, Middle East, I think we can also do a much more in terms of appreciating the country to which we have come, appreciating the welcome that we receive, appreciating the Shakespeare's, the Wordsworth's, the Shelley's, the Keats's of life. And I think along with the repentance that we feel is maybe needed on the part of those who may have been proud of the empire, we also need some appreciation of the spaces, the opportunities that we have to interact with this absolutely incredible country.
Thank you for everyone who's contributed to the circle. And thank you, Gandhiji, for being here. Question for you. Having spent time researching the book, I'm just curious, what kind of moved you most emotionally from studying Gandhiji's life, and kind of what advice do you think he may give us in our modern day, just having studied him and lived with him?
You read the book more recently than I have. So... to be honest, although I think he was fantastic, he certainly was also, like all human beings, he was not perfect. I myself, rightly or wrongly, I'm just telling you the honest truth, I don't spend too much time trying to figure out what Gandhiji would have advised today. So when I face a difficult question, I don't try to ask myself what Gandhi might have advised. I ask myself what my conscience and what my mind advise. I may often get it wrong, but that is where my search is. And I honestly think that is what Gandhi would want all of us to do, is to consult our own consciences, the deepest things that speak to us above all. Certainly, you also turn to him for inspiration, stimulus, encouragement. But for, he used to say to those who worked very closely with him, you know, there was this English lady, Madeline Slane, sometimes known as Mirabai, and she would again and again ask him, what shall I do, he would say, make God your guru, make God your guru.
And to his point about what is it that had the greatest emotional effect in looking at Gandhi's biography, maybe the first time or later in your life, what stands out as like the most touching thing that you have tried to embody in your life?
I think, as they sometimes say, I want notice to answer this question. I've not fully understood what... So what was the... Could you rephrase?
He was saying, what gave you an emotional, what did you most emotionally connect with, and how did that touch you from Gandhi's life?
Okay, I think what, yes, thank you very much, now I understand. I think what touched me the most in a way was how lonely Gandhi was. You see, he was always on the give. Very few thought. Now, I told you that how Bal Kalilkar assisted him at that moment. That was a very rare instance. Gandhi was a human being who needed encouragement, appreciation. He never sought it. He decided that he would be on the give no matter whether he received anything or not, but as a human being, he needed it. So as I lived with him his life, studied it, I saw how very, 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 very few people were on the give to him. Everybody was on the get from him.
Hello. I had a curious thought. We seem to be going through a time of suffering in the world. At least that's the kind of media perception. So I'm also aware there's the other side that we don't see if you switch on the TV and the news. But I was just curious, what are your thoughts around, do you think we lack a kind of modern day Martin Luther King or Gandhi? What are your thoughts around that? I'm also curious, maybe there is a modern day Gandhi, but we're just not aware of that person. So, or if we're lacking that person, why do you think that is in terms of political activism? Thank you.
Nipun, I think, why don't you answer?
No.
No, I don't think that our weakness is that we lack a modern day Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr., people of that kind. In any case, even if these were important gaps, it's not easy to see how we can fill them. The Gandhis and Kings do not appear on order. I think what Nipun has been saying, and I think what I also tried to imply when I said that Gandhi was always on the give, and so I think if more of us are willing all the time to be on the give and not worry too much about how we are being treated, worry more about how we treat others. Different ways of saying what all of you are aware of and are saying all the time to one another. And looking at the larger picture, there is really, when you say there is suffering in the world, it's absolutely true. There's a lot of pain in this world, a lot of sadness, very deep sadness in the world today. Also, there's great, incredible discoveries and advances that can just facilitate things, and of course, incredible ways in which people's lives are being saved and lengthened. So, I think each of us is capable of making a little difference each day, inspiring somebody else. And I think if each of us does whatever thing we can do, small or large, often each of us, even though we may think we're unimportant, we may be able to do some quite large things. Let us not underestimate ourselves. Each of us may do some big things also. But even if we do what we can, no matter how small it is, it will have an effect.
Please, Dad. I feel bad taking away from like airtime from.
No. You must.
And no, you know, I recently, so in Gandhian history, post Gandhi or during Gandhi's time, there was a gentleman named Vinoba Bhave whom Gandhi had the utmost respect for. They often saw each other as peers, although Vinoba would probably say he was Gandhi's student. And Vinoba, when it was time for Satyagraha, he coined that word, Gandhiji, and when he did, he named Vinoba as the first Satyagrahi, like a very high bar that he had for who is actually qualified to create this kind of change. And we had the great opportunity to be with somebody who spent decades of his life with Vinoba. He was just there with us for 6 weeks, first time in America, Arun Dada. And when he shared something very profound. He said that when Satyagraha doesn't work, we tend to think, because one of our friends is actually, I mean, this may sound funny without context, but this is a brother of mine, someone we all love, but he says, you know, these borders around countries are no good, and so he decided to go on this incredible long walk for hundreds of miles, and he says, we said, where are you going? And he says, I want to create a bonfire at the border of our passports. And Pancho walked for 93 days without any money, walked to the US-Mexico border, climbed up
the fence, climbed up the barbed wire, and there's a photo of him putting an earth flag saying, "We're one earth family." But when Arun Dada and Pancho met, Arun Dada gave him some wisdom from Vinoba, whom Gandhi said, "This is your model for a satyagrahi." He says that Vinoba would tell you that when you try to resist and create change, if that doesn't work, you have to become gentler. Not more coercive. Not saying, "Oh, you've got a hammer, I need a bigger hammer." You need to become gentler. And if the gentler satyagraha doesn't work, you need to become even gentler, even subtler. And so to go in that direction, and if you look at the world and you say, where are the Gandhis and, you know, Martin Luther Kings of the world? I think we live in such polarized times that we have gentler and subtler expressions of that Gandhian spirit that is being called for. And in that sense, it's not that a person is Gandhi. Rajmohanji actually is a very fair, gives a very fair portrayal of Gandhi, I feel. There's many people who just give, you know, glowing introductions or, you know, very harsh critiques. I feel like he's very fair. But if you take Gandhi, the person, out of it, right, and you talk about that spirit, and you say, how can I have more Gandhi moments? And what is a Gandhi moment? To engage with compassion, leading with inner transformation. And so maybe Gandhi had, you know, 1,000 such moments in a day, which is why he was Gandhi. Maybe I have one every leap year. But the question is, how do I go from 1 to 2? And it's the same question that Gandhi was asking, how do I go from 1,000 a day to 1,001? And in that inquiry, I think we're all connected. And that's a subtler inquiry than to have someone as a poster child in a centralized way, which we know doesn't work because all of these things are co-opted by market forces. So I think we live in times of very subtle satyagraha, but the question is the same. How can we live into, you know, how can you go from 1 to 2 or 1,000 to 1,001 Gandhi moments of meeting the world through the spirit of inner transformation?
Yeah. Thank you for the wisdom. I would be curious to hear how you or Gandhiji might address leaders or movements that were also in the name of justice or peace, but did not believe in nonviolence necessarily. Maybe the early Malcolm X or Che Guevara or Franz Fanon, Nat Turner. As someone who espouses nonviolence, you know, maybe it doesn't make sense to support these movements. And then maybe also because of nonviolence, it doesn't make sense to try to stop them. But then there's also the paradox of, I forget who said, maybe Fanon, there are no spectators, only those who are complicit and those who fight. So I'd be curious to hear how Gandhian thinking addresses this paradox.
Well, thank you for raising this very, very crucial question. So there's no doubt that at some level in the real world, all of us have to choose and say that, all right, we're all equally capable of horrible things, but some manifestation of selfishness or greed or hatred is so dangerous to all of us that we have to put up a fight against it. I think that is absolutely inevitable, inescapable. I think there has been enough evidence accumulated in the last several, say last 150 years, that revolutions against injustice carried out with violence, carried out under a centralized direction, have created almost in every single case greater misery than they tried to resolve. Whether it is the Soviet Union, whether it is China, and there can be other examples, there really is no evidence that that kind of violent revolution improved the lives of ordinary people at all. If anything, lives became much worse. So that is enough reason for us to be very cautious about calls for revolution against injustice using violence and justifying assassinations and killings. This is different from saying that sometimes you have to use arms to defend a country or to defend the innocent people. Here, incidentally, you know, there's an amazing, I found recently some wonderful quotes from Gandhi on whether or not a sword or a gun at all can have any use. Some of you know, many of you, I don't know whether some here are connected with the Sikh background, but the kirpan is a very sacred thing in Sikh tradition and history. So during the terrible carnage of 47, where Hindus and Sikhs and Muslims all killed one another, and there was a horrible parity in cruelty. So Gandhi then said that a kirpan, this sword or dagger, which had a religious significance for many Sikhs, adorns its wearer only when it is used heroically and bravely against heavy odds to protect the innocent. He didn't say kirpan should never be used. He said it should only be used so it will only adorn its user or wearer when it is used bravely against heavy odds to protect the innocent. So I think if we can restrict violence to that role, that our police, our soldiers must only use violence when it is absolutely unavoidable, as the last resort, against heavy odds, to protect the innocent. I think if that is our understanding of violence, and therefore we shun it, or we, if we're obliged to use it for justice, use it that way, but no more. But this is a very limited response to your profoundly important question, and I only hope that you and others like you will find more relevant and more satisfying answers.
Yes.
Awesome. We need to end. Okay. All right.
Well, thank you all for being here and sharing in this space together. To close, what we would like to invite Junwei. First of all, I want to thank Junwei, because he was supposed to share and speak today, and I was gonna put him on the spot. And he just super invisibly said, no, do whatever needs to be done. So I really appreciate your big-heartedness. And I hope you continue to stay an Avesta monk forever, because you continue to shine the way for so many of us in so many ways. One of the things he did yesterday was sing a compassion chant. And so I invite you to share a little context and close out our circle with a compassion chant.
So maybe first I want to thank all of you and distinguished guests for the wisdom. What we received here is very, I feel very boosted by compassion and kindness by being all around all of you. What very struck me about Gandhi, what we hear, how important for him was praying. And I think Gandhi couldn't be become who he was without praying. I think same could be say Martin Luther King. Dalai Lama probably agree with this. Mother Teresa. And those are in the question of what we can do in the lack of these enlightenment teachers. I can say we can use tools what they used. And praying is one of them. And we are so blessed to be among so many wonderful people here. We represent so many different traditions. We carry wonderful ancient devices, I can say, ancient technologies from Hindu tradition, from Muslims, from Christian, Buddhist, and the power of the chant of the is for me this is like a key who can open our heart, our consciousness, and is full of infinite goodness, compassion, and joy. And it work when we use it. If we had used the key, it change not gonna happen. And I think this is very significant, the change. And also for Gandhi, right? Be the change we want to see in the world. It was his main message. And through those devices, we can make a change in our heart. I can say in the smallest place in the world, the place when our thoughts, emotions arises, is the place where we can make a change. We can make it a different. We can become someone else. And maybe short, really short story, and I will offer the chant as a kind of concluding. The one of my heroes and monk who I am very deeply respect, Rabbi Hank Schur, who I came from the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery when we when he's abbot, the abbot, as many of you know, that he at some point of his life decided to make a pilgrimage, three steps, one bow, for the world peace. And some people were, what? This is ridiculous. How we can change the world by doing the prostration to the ground? And his teacher says that the change, real change, can happen if you transform your greed, delusion, and hatred. This is the best gifts what we can offer to the world by real change. And as sometimes we can be confused, it's so many things to do. I'm angry maybe many times in the day. How can I make a change? And advice to two bowing monks in the beginning of their journey was from Master Hua, who was their teacher, that, and by the way, it takes 3 years for them to accomplish this pilgrimage. It was 800 miles of journey. He said, don't look on the over. Don't look in the end of your journey. Make sure the next step is true. And I can say, it's good to make sure that our thoughts is true and honest and sincere. And the chant can remind us and kind of permeate this space when we can have courage to make a change by changing one small thoughts. And the change is related to Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the Guan Shuin in the Chinese tradition, Canon in Japanese tradition, Quan Thanh Bo, that in Vietnamese we have many names, but the one message, to bring compassion to the world. And the Great Compassion Mantra is her tool to remind and purify the field that we can enter to this place. So if you know the chant, you can join me, or you can just be in tune in your heart, or you can chant your chant silently. We are joined together and can offer to this wonderful meeting, to this wonderful country and the whole world, our thoughts, good inspirations, and our good wishes. So I will start with this. Namo halai donai dolaiye, namo aliye puru jedi, shobolaiye buddhisa dopoye, moha sa dopoye, moha jalu nijaye, nansa palafaye, soda danasye, namo si jedi to into moriye, puru jedi shirfo lalan topo, namo no larjin tu, Siri Moha Pandu Samye Sapo Ata Dersh Panershuin Sapo Sado Namo Bo Sado Namo Poche Mova Dedo Tarji Dane No Puru Siru Jari Jaro Di Siri Moha Puti Sato Sapo Sapo Molai Molai Musi Musi Rintoin Jiru jiru jeno dulu dulu vashe yedi moha vashe yedi Tolai tolai didi ni shirfo laye jela jela momo famola Modiri si si shirno shirno ala shen vola sheri Vasha vashen vala sheye hulu hulu molai hulu hulu siri Solai solai siri siri suru suru putiye putiye putoye putoye midiriye nalai jinchu diri shainino poye mono sopoha sitoye sopoha moha sitoye sopoha nalai jinchu panche laye sopoha mopo li shenche laye sopoha Namo halai donai dolaiye, namo aliye puru jedi, shopan laiye sopoha, nansi dendo mandala patoye sopoha. Namo halai donai dolaiye, namo aliye puru jedi, shopan laiye sopoha, nansi dendo mandala patoye sopoha. Invite for the 1 minute silence in the end.